From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the authors of two Pulitzer Prize-winning biographies on two powerful figures. William Taubman won the award this week for his book on Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader who provoked the two biggest crises of the Cold War, one in Berlin, the other in Cuba. And Jack Miles, who won the prize in 1996 for his book, which profiles God as the protagonist of the Old Testament. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Alamo. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. William Taubman just won the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Biography for his book Khrushchev, The Man and His Era. During the years Khrushchev was the leader of the Soviet Union, from 1954 to 64, he provoked the two biggest crises of the Cold War, one in Berlin, the other in Cuba. In a Washington Post review, Robert Kaiser described Taubman's book as a masterful and monumental biography. Taubman started researching the book in the 80s, before the collapse of the Soviet Union. After the collapse, he gained access to newly opened Soviet archives. Terry spoke with William Taubman last year, right after his book was published.
Let's start with the things that Khrushchev is responsible for that have changed the world in profound ways. If you could just list some of the things that Khrushchev was behind that have had a profound effect on the shape of the former Soviet Union and the world.
I think the single most profound effect was of the secret speech he gave in 1956, unmasking Stalin as a tyrant. The effect of that essentially was to begin the end of the Soviet Union by destroying a god whom so many had worshipped and which had legitimized or helped legitimize Soviet rule. So that was an epical event both for the Soviet Union and the world. If one shifts to foreign affairs, I think the event I would probably choose is the Cuban missile crisis, the decision to send to Cuba missiles capable of reaching the United States with nuclear weapons, triggering a crisis which was eventually resolved peacefully, but which could have sparked a nuclear conflict.
Let's get back to the secret speech in which he talked about Stalin. He knew Stalin very well. He was one of the top people under Stalin. Did he have any objections to what Stalin was doing when he was working with Stalin and carrying out Stalin's orders?
This is a kind of mystery, but I think I have at least partially resolved it. If you read what he said in public during the Stalin years when he was one of his closest henchmen, you would have thought he had no doubts about Stalin. But of course, he had to talk that way. If you read his memoirs, you discover that he is critical of Stalin, but in a puzzling, surprising way, he still manages to praise Stalin at a point when he had no conceivable reason to do so. So the puzzle remains. The thing that helped me solve it was on one of my trips to the Soviet Union, I went down to Ukraine and to the city called Donetsk in eastern Ukraine, where Khrushchev had been an official, had sort of grown up and been an official in his early years. And I found a woman who was the daughter of one of his very best friends from childhood. And she had been there and witnessed a conversation between Khrushchev and her father in 1940. When Khrushchev confessed to her father, with nobody else present, that he was angry and almost in a rage about what some of Stalin was doing. And when she told me this story, I couldn't believe it. But she described it in detail, and then I found some further documents which supported it, and I slowly came to the conclusion that Khrushchev had harbored dismay, anger, maybe even rage, and that had come out in a flood in 1956 and was one of the main reasons why he gave that speech.
What did he say in that speech?
Well, it was a partial unmasking of this terrible tyrant. It did not criticize everything Stalin had done. It drew a kind of line in 1934 and said that until then, Stalin had done many good things, and of course we know that many of the things he did before 34, like ordering the collectivization of agriculture in which millions died, were not good. But Khrushchev drew the line in 1934 and said it was after that that the terrible things began. So that makes it sound as if it was a kind of moderate compromise of a speech, but it certainly didn't sound that way to the people who were in the hall that morning in February 1956.
Who was in the hall? Who was he addressing?
Well, he was talking to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and that means the top elite of the members of the Central Committee, which is a smaller group, and then several thousand more, the elite. And this included people who, many of whom were Stalinists, many of whom had blood on their hands, many of whom secretly had hated Stalin. But none of them had expected what they heard that morning, which was this attack on Stalin himself. So there was a kind of deathly silence in the hall. One of the people I talked to or I read about said there was a kind of buzzing noise in response to what they were hearing. They sort of left the hall in silence. They were absolutely thunderstruck that their leader had done this.
You're not supposed to talk about this stuff if you're under a totalitarian regime. Did this help or hurt Khrushchev?
Well, I think it helped him to feel as if, in the end, he was an honest man, that he had a conscience and he had acted on it. I think it also helped him, or so he thought, that he had sort of cleared the air. One of the reasons he did it, I think, was that he believed that if he didn't do it then, that somebody else would do it a few years later, and then the question would be, why hadn't he done it? He also felt that it helped him because, bloody as his hands were, some of his leaders, his co-leaders, some of his colleagues in the leadership were even more complicit in Stalinist evil, and so by unmasking Stalin, he was really unmasking them, which was a good thing for him, or so he thought, in his battle against them for leadership of the Communist Party. So, and in one other way, I think he thought it was a good thing for him. He was a kind of idealist and a true believer, and he believed in socialism, communism, and he thought that once he had purged it of this terrible Stalinist stain, it would go on and inspire people forever. So he thought it was a good thing, but I think it turned out to be not a very good thing for him because turmoil exploded in the Soviet Union, not really demonstrations, but at meetings. Then there were strikes and demonstrations and people killed in Poland shortly thereafter. And then there was the Hungarian Revolution in November 1956, in which the Soviets had to invade. So in the long run, it was devastating, really, for the communist system, and it was devastating for Khrushchev.
It was devastating for the communist system because why would people put up with it once Stalin was unmasked and they started to rebel?
Yes, because because he had been a kind of god. His godlike status had been one of the things that people had been forced to believe in. Many of them did believe sincerely. Others pretended to. It had held the system together. And to say suddenly that this figure, the leader of the country, the leader of the party, the leader of world communism, the leader of all progressive forces, or that's the kind of way they would have put it, was in effect a mass murderer, was to begin the unraveling of communism in the Soviet Union and eventually everywhere.
One of the great contradictions about Khrushchev is, on the one hand, he criticizes Stalin for the bloodbaths and many human rights abuses, and at the same time, Khrushchev is guilty of plenty of human rights abuses himself.
Well, he certainly was. He was the party leader in Moscow at the height of the most terrible purges, the Great Terror of the in 1937-38. And there are documents which show that he not only carried out orders to approve executions, but in at least one case asked for the quota to be increased. And among the people who died, not at his own direct hand, but with his approval, were some of his absolutely closest associates, friends whom he had known for years. And then in 1938, Stalin sent him. He'd done so well as his in this job in Moscow. Stalin sent him down to Ukraine, where he was the party boss of the whole Ukraine. And there too, again, he signed documents. I found one in an archive. I remember in the KGB archive in Kiev, a document, an indictment of a particular leader of the Young Communist League in Ukraine, and scrawled across the top in Khrushchev's familiar handwriting was the word arrest, N. Khrushchev. So we know he had blood on his hands there. If you ask the question why, that's another story, but there's no doubt that he had blood. As he himself said in retirement at one point in a conversation, he said, "I have blood up to my elbows."
William Taubman, speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back with Terry's 2003 interview with William Taubman, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Nikita Khrushchev.
One of the things you wanted to know is, how did he manage to have such a contradictory personality and such a contradictory set of achievements? Part of your investigation was psychological. You consulted psychiatrists and psychologists, presented them information about Khrushchev, and asked for their analysis. What are some of the things that they told you about his personality based on the information you gave them?
Well, I have to admit, it wasn't so much that they gave me an analysis. It was more that I tried out my own notions with some great hesitation, because I'm not a psychologist myself.
Mm-hmm.
So with their help in that sense, I developed several notions. I developed the notion, for example, that this was an ignorant peasant in the beginning. He grew up in a poor peasant village. His parents didn't even have a horse, let alone a house. He had probably no more than 2 years of elementary education, possibly three or four. He's a little vague on it. Twice later on, he goes back to school, attempting to get an adult education program. And each time he gets distracted by politics. So this man is, as the sculptor Ernst Niedersvesny said once, the most uncultured man I'd ever met in my life. But he has great hopes for himself, I think, fostered in part by a particularly powerful mother who seems to have idolized him, and also by a school teacher who told him that he could do anything. So he sets out to do anything, and he succeeds. He moves miraculously up in the Communist Party ladder, into Stalin's inner circle, eventually becomes the leader of the Soviet Union. But I think he was sort of plagued not only by his primitiveness, which remained, but by his knowledge of it. And then complicating that even further is that the way he survives as Stalin's henchman in a time when so many did not is by playing the fool. So the irony is that he's forced to play the fool to survive, but the fool is what he doesn't want to be. And in this sense, he sort of goes through life succeeding. When he gets the full power, he's suddenly responsible for the welfare of a transcontinental empire in all of its aspects. He's not really equipped to do it. In trying to do it, he ends up making terrible mistakes, which prove him in some ways to be as foolish as he feared he would be. And so by the end of the time in power, just before he's ousted, there's a kind of surreal quality to him. He's just undermining himself left and right without seeming to realize that that's what he's doing. He's alienating all of his supporters just when he needs them. He's sparking a conspiracy against him.
You describe Khrushchev as having been prone to depressions, alcoholism, hypomania.
I got the term hypomania from the CIA, believe it or not.
What does it mean? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the CIA gathered about 20 shrinks together at one point in 1961 to prepare a study of Khrushchev for President Kennedy, who was going to be jousting with him shortly at a summit in Vienna. And of course, that study hasn't been released, but one of the people who was there did release an account of it. And the account says they decided, after looking at interviews, interviewing people who'd met Khrushchev and looking at film, that he was hypomanic. What hypomanic means, it's a sort of subclinical case of bipolarity. That is, there's mania, there's depression, but they're not so serious as to paralyze him. And he functions quite actively and at times quite well. But nonetheless, there is this tendency toward explosiveness and impulsiveness, and the sense I can do anything and I can do it now, on the one hand, coexisting with moods of sort of bleakness and blackness and sadness. And after I read that, I interviewed Jane Thompson, who was the wife of the American ambassador, Llewellyn Thompson, who flew with the Khrushchevs to America in 59. And Jane Thompson said, Nina Khrushcheva, Khrushchev's wife, had said to her on that flight, he's always either all the way up or all the way down. So I felt that was enough confirmation.
How do you think that these mood swings have affected his style as a negotiator? you know, as a negotiator with the United States, as a negotiator during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, I think one way to put the decision to send those missiles to Cuba with all the risks involved and without consulting with his most knowledgeable advisors was to say it was a manic move. You know, it was he suddenly had confidence that he could do anything. And some of the other things that he did were probably also reflected that. I mean, I dare say that even the speech attacking Stalin probably reflected this sort of sense that he could do this tremendous, stunning thing that nobody had expected. I'm certainly not reducing any of the things that he did to this particular feature of his psychology, but I think it was there in the background. And as a negotiator, it made for some absolutely hair-raising and very funny negotiations. One of my favorites, if I can tell you about it, is with Senator Hubert Humphrey, who was pretty effervescent himself, one might say. And Humphrey goes to Moscow in December, I think it was, 1958, to try to figure out what Khrushchev's up to with this Berlin ultimatum of his. And he expects to get, if he's lucky, maybe an hour with Khrushchev. He ends up spending 8 hours in the Kremlin. Khrushchev wines him and dines him. And at one point, Khrushchev sort of gets up, goes over to a map on the wall and says, "Where are you from?" And Humphrey says, "Minneapolis, Minnesota." And Khrushchev takes out a fat blue pencil and draws a circle around it and says, "That means we'll spare Minneapolis when the rockets fly." And Humphrey, who is no slouch, says, "Well, I'm afraid I can't do the same for Moscow. Sorry about that." And Humphrey was absolutely snowed. He said, "I never met a guy like him. He said, I loved him like, I wish, I don't remember exactly what the words were. I could open my book and find them. But he says, I had the greatest time with this guy. This guy was amazing. He gave the best speech I ever heard against racism. But he also went away saying that the Americans should assign some sort of psychologist to study him because he had a tremendous inferiority complex and they better figure him out before something bad happened."
How is Khrushchev described now in Russian textbooks?
Well, he's gone from being a non-person, which is what he was all the years after he was ousted until Gorbachev resurrected him as a sort of predecessor, somebody who tried to reform the Soviet Union before Gorbachev renewed the attempt. So he's treated as a man who tried his best to make the changes that were necessary, but he's also treated as somebody who has blood on his hands. I think the irony is that these days Russians don't pay all that much attention to him. Their lives are too complicated. They're too busy surviving. They're too busy trying to get ahead, and they don't, as a rule, I think, want to pay that much attention to their past.
What's your final analysis of Khrushchev?
I feel a kind of affection for him. He's a wonderfully colorful character. He's a sort of self-made man who couldn't unmake what his origins had made of him. He's a man who found himself in a situation where he was committing great wrongs and tried to repent and do good. He's all too human in so many ways. I find as a person there are things that I admire and things that are almost embarrassing. He was profane. There's a lot of profanity in this book. And as a political leader, he's also contradictory. He was an accomplice of Stalin and Stalin's terrible crimes, but at the same time, he tried to change his country. He was naive in thinking he could do it, but that naivete was also something to admire. He tried to mitigate the Cold War and ease it, if not absolutely end it, and instead of easing it, he produced its two worst crises. So he's an incredibly complex, contradictory, fascinating character for whom I feel both affection and admiration on the one hand and almost revulsion if one's talking about the bloody years and a kind of disdain on the other.
Well, William Taubman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
William Taubman, speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. His biography of Nikita Khrushchev, Khrushchev, the Man and His Era, just won the Pulitzer Prize. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Whisker of Evil, a Mrs. Murphy mystery by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, authors of The Tale of the Tip-Off. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our visit with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographers. We talk with literary critic and former Jesuit seminarian Jack Miles. In 1996, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, God, a Biography. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Alamo, starring Billy Bob Thornton and Jason Patrick. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The book, God, a Biography, won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography in 1996. It was written by Jack Miles. The book offers a literary examination of the Bible and analyzes God as the protagonist of the Old Testament. Miles is in a good position to take this unusual approach. He's a former Jesuit seminarian and Bible scholar who studied in Rome and Jerusalem. For 7 years, he was the Los Angeles Times literary editor. He's also the author of Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God, which was published in 2001. In 2002, Miles was the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. When Terry spoke with Miles in 1996, she asked if he responded to the Bible in different ways as a seminarian and as a scholar. He says, sometimes, when you are employing the Bible for worship or instruction, you leave certain things out or gloss over them.
When did you first start reading the Bible?
As a boy, I read the New Testament. And we had some books of Bible stories, I think, at home. I recall in particular a Sunday morning television show that I used to watch in which the Bible was read, and then there were sort of semi-dramatizations of it. And it was there that I believe I first felt a kind of irritation with God, or a kind
of irritation.
Irritation, or that's perhaps the right word. Call it puzzlement. I was disturbed that some of his behavior seemed unacceptable, but no one was saying anything about it.
The more destructive side.
The more destructive side, yeah. I recently took the trouble to, this isn't anything I did as a boy, but I think I was seeing some of this. I took the trouble to count up how many Israelites God kills between the time when he takes Israel out of Egypt and out of bondage to Pharaoh and the time that he leads them across the Jordan River into the Promised Land. I stopped counting at 40,000. That's quite a few. That's Israelites. That's his own people.
Your book, God, a Biography, is based on a reading of the Jewish Old Testament, not the Christian version of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between the two?
Okay, the original is Hebrew, and Jews who speak English read a translation into English. Christians who speak English also read a translation into English. So they're both reading translations of the same original. Christians, when they were first translating the Bible into Greek and Latin, rearranged the order in which the books come. The first books, from Genesis until the second book of Kings, are in the same order when Christians read and when Jews read. But thereafter, the orders are quite strikingly different. All the books of prophecy have been moved to the end in the Christian ordering, and they remain in the middle in the Jewish ordering. Now, if I were to take any book that you might care to mention, David Copperfield, and say, well, we'll leave the first 40% just as it is, but then the latter 60% we'll rearrange and we'll take the middle 30% and move it to the end. Well, you'd have a very different story.
Well, how is the story different in the Jewish Bible than in the Christian Old Testament?
The difference is that in the middle, where you have the books of prophecy in the Jewish ordering, you have great hope, a great sense of expectation. Jerusalem has been destroyed. The nation is in exile. And yet God has promised that he will forgive them. He will bring them back. And wonderful things will happen, more wonderful than they had in their moments of greatest earlier glory. When Christianity takes those books with all that hopefulness and moves them to the end, it moves all that hope and all that expectation to just before the appearance of Jesus. And it gives you, if you were to look only at the Old Testament, it gives you a story that begins strong, then goes into a period of kind of quietness and aimlessness or confusion, and then ends with a great rush of hope. In the Jewish ordering, you have the actions of God at the beginning, and then this speech and all this hope in the middle, and then a tailing off with the book of Job as the climactic moment. So that the what I call the books of silence are the final books in the Jewish ordering.
So in a way, in the Christian reordering, ending on that more hopeful note, it's kind of like the sequel is "And Christ Comes."
Well, that's
fulfilling
exactly
that hopeful
that's exactly
prophecy.
It.
But in the Jewish version, it ends with the book of Job. So how do you interpret that? What kind of note does the Jewish version end on?
Well, let me mention that the book of Job is not the last book in the Hebrew Bible as Jews read it. There follow about 10 more books. One of these,
but Job is the last place where God
Job
speaks.
Job is the climactic moment,
and it's the last place where God speaks in the Jewish version of the Bible.
But it's still what lies ahead is it's, as it seems to me, a kind of transfer of authority, and the Jewish people themselves, we begin by various hints to recognize, are now expected to do for themselves what God used to do for them, and the. Where this becomes clearest for me is in the story of the book of Esther. In the story of the book of Esther, the same situation obtains that obtained in Pharaoh's Egypt. The Jews are a minority people living in a great empire, and the emperor has turned against them and wants to exterminate them. In Egypt, they call on God to rescue them, and he does with great spectacular power. In the book of Esther, they take care of it themselves. They never pray to him. They never call on him. The book of Esther is remarkable for being the one book in the Hebrew Bible in which God is not even mentioned. If the initial situations weren't so similar, it might not tell us much. But when they are so very similar, I think the suggestion is inescapable that though God is still existent and still honored, and Israel is still his people, they are to handle for themselves things that in an earlier age he had handled for them.
So the Jewish Bible ends with a sense of take responsibility for your lives. I'm still here. You know, God's saying I'm still here, but take responsibility
correct.
For your lives.
Correct. That's by the way, is a you might call it a melancholy ending or a somewhat rueful ending, but it certainly is not a tragic ending or any. There's no sense of failure. There's a sense of a kind of empowerment, if you will, at the end of the Hebrew Bible and the Jewish ordering.
Do you think of yourself as a religious man as well as a scholar?
Yes, I do. And to me, that is a matter more of taking certain questions seriously than of defending any single answer to the death. It's a matter of humility, and it's also a matter, in a way, of skepticism, not skepticism about religion, but skepticism about everything else. If I felt that an adequate answer was to be had from science or science and art together, I might somehow move on and leave the religious questions behind. But I find all of those sources of wisdom, I respect them, of course, finally inadequate. And I'm dazzled by the achievements of science and charmed by the gifts of art. But finally, it's not enough.
Jack Miles speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with Jack Miles. She asked if he responded to the Bible in different ways as a seminarian and as a scholar. He says, sometimes. When you are employing the Bible for worship or instruction, you leave certain things out or gloss over them.
I taught the flood story in Sunday school one time, and I noticed that my instructions were to go easy on the violence of God might upset the children, and stress the rainbow that comes at the end and God's promise not to do this again. Children are sometimes very sensitive, the teacher's manual said, and we don't want. And also they have very tender feelings about their animals, and the fact that God destroyed all these animals, you know, could upset them. Someone might say, well, let them take it straight. After all, it's the word of God. I don't feel that way. I think that that the text can be used and combined with other materials and adjusted any way that religious authorities wish, so long as they understand what they're doing. It's not really written for children, I'd have to say, though, and there is great merit in allowing a completely adult, free reading of it to take place. And indirectly, there can be some religious gains from that.
Let me ask you, when you were teaching Sunday school, did any of the children become upset when they heard the story of God, you know, destroying everything that he'd create, well, nearly everything that he'd created?
Well, they
what
didn't.
What kind of questions did they want to know, and how did you answer
them? They didn't, because I followed the instructions. I mean, we began.
You played it down.
I played it down. I mean, the instructions were, we got a little teaching kit, and there was a picture of a rainbow, and the rainbow comes at the end of the story, you
uh-huh.
know. But the instructions were to pass out the rainbow card at the beginning. And then just to be on the safe side, we ended the class with a reading of the 23rd Psalm, you know, the Lord is my shepherd. I thought that was laying it on a bit thick. But I did it, and so no one was upset. But a good friend of mine tried to read the text just as you find it aloud to his son, and stopped. You know, he stopped. He himself was shocked at what he was reading, and realized that what he remembered from his childhood wasn't the Bible, but Bible stories. Bible stories are just that. You know, they're the expurgated version that we teach to children, and the notion is so widely spread that the Bible is for children. You know, that this becomes rather the standard.
Well, you know, it's funny. The flood story, the way I always remember it, the destruction isn't stressed. It's the, all the cute animals,
all
two
the
by
cute
two,
animals,
going
two by two,
the,
going in.
Into the
I mean,
ark.
It's a wonderful, wonderfully pictorial story, and sure, no harm is done, I guess, but something is definitely obscured about this story. You know, in the Israel got its flood story from ancient Babylon, and in Babylon there was a creator god who stood for social order and dry land, and then there was a destroyer goddess, actually, a kind of flood monster who stood for chaos and destruction, and they fought each other. So you had one on one side and the other on the other side. After monotheism, the two became one. So in our master myth, God creates the world. The same God then destroys the world. Makes for a better story, I think, actually, but a much more mysterious one. And if you don't allow the destructive part of that story to shine through, you lose something, I think.
Well, now I really want to hear your interpretation of the flood story, looking at the Bible as a book of literature. Mm-hmm. What do you think the flood story says about God? You're the author of God, a biography.
What it says is that that there's more to him than we have seen in his story to this point. You know, let me remind you of what God said during the days of creation. After the end of each day, God looks at the world and sees that it is good. Tov is the Hebrew word. Tov, tov. And then tov ma'od, he says on the last day, very good. And now he looks on the world again, and what does he see? Traditional translations say he sees that the world is corrupt, suggesting that mankind is the problem, moral evil. But in fact, the word that is used, the word ra, is the most general Hebrew word for evil. It's just the opposite of what he saw at creation. And he hasn't given any Ten Commandments yet. He hasn't given even one commandment, except the one he gave to Adam and Eve in the garden, and they're not in the garden anymore.
So it's not like he's punishing humanity for breaking God's rules.
No, he's not. So what then do you have? What you have is a rather disturbing change of heart in him. It isn't that something has happened. It is that that he mysteriously has changed, or else that something that we hadn't had opportunity to see in him before has now suddenly erupted, has bubbled up.
Now, have you found any explanation for that?
The explanation is, If you simply take the text as you find it, the explanation can only be a characterological explanation. This is the way he is. You have to take him as you find him. Historically, of course, Israel did receive its creation myth from Babylon, and there was a creator god, Marduk, and a destroyer god, Tiamat. Marduk was the god of social order and of dry land, and Tiamat was a kind of flood monster, a dragon. Imagine a wandering, sinuous river. Looks rather snaky in its shape, and then suddenly it swells up and swallows everything. You know, that's what she was. But in our text, he and she are just he. We have one God playing both roles.
So you're saying that some of the contradictions in God's personality in the Bible is really a function of monotheism, that formerly there was a God for destruction and a God for creation, a God for love and a God for hate, for good and for evil. And now it's like monotheism. There's one God, and so all those contradictory things in life have to be embodied in this one figure.
That's right. And that, I think, isn't as...
Except for Satan. We've got Satan.
Well, except for Satan. Well, yes, but he's... I mean, he doesn't play any role until very, very late.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
He does appear there in he appears at the very beginning as the serpent who tempts Eve, you know, in the Garden of Eden. Then he's gone, and we don't hear from him again essentially until the Book of Job, and all the intervening time, God is the only God who matters, and all the others are simply fictions. What isn't generally recognized is the extent to which the character of God, the what he is like, never mind whether he exists or not, but what he is like comes about by this amalgamation, this fusion.
Into monotheism.
Yes, into monotheism. So that monotheism is a kind of sum total of all gods, with reality denied to any god operating under another name.
Jack Miles, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. His book, God, a Biography, won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography that year. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Alamo, the new movie, not the old tourist attraction. This is Fresh Air. Hollywood's most famous treatment of the legendary Battle of the Alamo, the 1960 movie called The Alamo, starred John Wayne as Davy Crockett and Richard Widmark as Jim Bowie. The protagonists of the new film, also called The Alamo, are played by Billy Bob Thornton and Jason Patrick, with Dennis Quaid as General Sam Houston. David Edelstein has a review.
The director of the new Alamo movie, who bears the revolutionary name John Lee Hancock, vowed to make the definitive story of the fabled Texas Last Stand, not like that piece of ahistorical myth-making propaganda fashioned by John Wayne in 1960 at the height of the Cold War. It's true that the rah-rah jingoism of this new Alamo is not as in-your-face, that it's a carefully and relatively nuanced retelling, and that parts of it are affecting in a mournful post-9/11 way. But the absence of politics is politics, too. And Hancock's Alamo is likely to leave most people scratching their heads and wondering, what's the backstory here? It's been suggested over the years that the defense of this crumbling San Antonio mission without the support of U.S. troops might not have been the wisest move, and that the Texians, as they were called, were actually trying to pull off something of a land grab at a time when the Mexicans had only just won their freedom from Spain. But there is no denying the valor of the men who fought and died at the Alamo. Most famously, the Tennessee frontiersman turned politician turned entertainer Davy Crockett, the ambitious land swindler with the custom-made knife Jim Bowie, and the young, in-over-his-head Lieutenant Colonel William Travis. In this telling, the story of the Alamo is one of those quintessential American myths, ragtag underdogs outmanned and outgunned, holding their own against a large and better-equipped and sadistic foe. The sadists in this case aren't the ordinary Mexican soldiers, who are brave and decent, but their leader, General Santa Anna, portrayed by the Mexican actor Emilio Echevarria as a cigar-smoking voluptuary who relishes the execution of his prisoners. A lot of events in the movie are telescoped. The real Alamo fighters had months to prepare for Santa Anna and his thousands of troops. But here their arrival is a shock, most of all to Crockett, played by Billy Bob Thornton, who has come to Texas to revitalize his political career and didn't figure on anyone shooting at him.
Now, there was this little detail of a re-election back home. It's all right. It's all right. Because you know what I told them folks?
What'd you tell them?
I said, you all can go to hell. I'm going to Texas.
Yeah. Welcome to Texas, baby.
Thank you, sir.
Put your mark on it, Mr. Crockett.
Look out. Let me through here.
Absolutely.
I'm half alligator, half snapping turtle. I can slide off a rainbow and jump to Mississippi in a single leap. Tell them, David. Hey, you can whoop your weight in Wildcats. I seen you on stage.
Well, that wasn't me.
Why, sure it was.
No, sir, that's just an actor in a play. He's performing a character.
Oh, come on, Davey. Say the lines. Davy Crockett, the Lion of the West.
I dare Santana show his face now you're here.
Well, I understood the fighting was over. Ain't it?
That's a terrific bit. And the best part of the Alamo is the conception of Crockett, a man trapped by his own mythic persona, who by the end fills the legend out. Thornton is warm and funny, and he anchors the scenes with Jason Patrick's terminally ill Bowie, who's good but perilously low-key, and Patrick Wilson's Travis, who's good but hobbled by poor screenwriting. Dennis Quaid has worse luck as General Sam Houston, a drunk who urged Bowie to abandon the Alamo and then refused to take Travis's panicked missive seriously. Houston gives oddly vague responses, and Quaid drops his voice and pops his eyes and looks rather constipated. Director Hancock doesn't seem to know what to do with this character, who lets hundreds of men die, but then comes back to life post-massacre as an avenger, as Wellington to Santa Anna's Napoleon. That's because Hollywood retellings of disasters like the Alamo and Pearl Harbor need to end with Americans getting their own back. Americans did, of course. They got Texas, which Santa Anna signed over in return for his life, earning everlasting disgrace in his native country. But thanks to Hancock's muddy storytelling, it's never clear why so few Texians came to the aid of the Alamo in the course of the siege. The middle of the movie is pokey and unfocused, and given the circumstances, bizarrely lacking in urgency. It's possible, though, that the pacing is true to what actually happened in the course of that siege. No one in the U.S. quite realized the peril. What I took away from this Alamo is that nothing motivates us like revenge. When we remember the Alamo, we don't remember the reasons we shouldn't have fought or the lives that were needlessly lost. We remember the galvanizing power of martyrdom. We remember that people, especially Americans, often never know quite how they feel about something until they're mad as hell about it.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Actor Victor Argo died this week in New York at age 69. His name may not be familiar, but you'd recognize his voice and certainly his face. He played the tough guy, the hard-boiled detective, or the gangster in over 70 movies. Argo had roles in the Martin Scorsese films Mean Streets and Taxi Driver. He was also in a number of films directed by Abel Ferrara, including The Bad Lieutenant and The King of New York. In that 1990 film, he plays an aging but still tough detective who has been trying to build a case against a murderous drug lord named Frank White, played by Christopher Walken. Here's a scene from the end of the film, the final confrontation between those two really tough guys, which takes place in the New York subway. Walken's character is holding one of the passengers hostage.
Let it go.
You let it go.
Frank, put the gun down.
I make it easy. I've done things in my life that you wouldn't even think about. Why should you be different? You got that gun, use it. Come on!
No more stories, Frank. Put the f***ing gun down.
See this woman? Nice woman. You have a family? I don't want to hurt you, but I would blow you away if I had to. You understand?
Yes.
Could you do that?
Leave him alone, Frank. It's me and you. Me and you. You can't hide behind it forever.
I don't need forever.
A scene from the 1990 film The King of New York, starring Christopher Walken and featuring actor Victor Argo. Argo died earlier this week. He was 69. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the new novel Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood, author of The Blind Assassin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic and actor Ricky Gervais. He stars in the BBC sitcom series The Office as the nightmare boss. The Office recently received the Peabody Award. Also, novelist Tom Parada. His new comic novel about bad parenting in suburbia is Little Children. Join us for the next Fresh Air.